Hey, it's James Dean's Mind. This is episode number 4 of The Art of Letting Go. Today we're going to discuss those second, third, and fourth chances at life that I mentioned in the last episode, and the guilt that comes with it. It actually has a name, and we'll discuss it today on The Art of Letting Go. Well, I learned something recently. I can say that social media has its purpose outside of me watching Basset Hound videos and laughing at political memes. October is Liver Awareness Month. It's National Liver Awareness Month. And that's a conversation that I never mind having, to be honest with you, even though they might only label it for 1 month. For me, Liver Awareness Month is 12 months a year, every single year, and has been for probably the last 13 years or so. After I received my liver transplant just 5 years ago, life felt different. Life felt new. Life also carried with it an immense amount of guilt, knowing that someone else died so that I could live. There's a name for that. It's called survivor's guilt. And of all the things that's hard to let go, this may be the greatest. I'll tell you more on the other side. Okay, so to do this particular portion with fidelity and to give it the attention I think it rightly deserves, I'm going to split this story into 2 episodes. I do not want to go beyond the half hour that we are enjoying together. So I think to best serve both sides of this story, to understand why guilt happens when such a life-saving gift comes along, I think it's okay to walk you through my transplantation, and then in the next episode to talk more specifically about the person who gave me that gift and how our lives, before we knew it, kept somehow finding each other along this path that we call life, before she ultimately gave me a part of herself so that I can carry on. So I'll start on my side, and I hope you'll understand as we go why this disease is so damning, why it has this effect on people, because my experience is not my experience alone. A lot of this is similar to what people with my specific type of primary sclerosing cholangitis go through. I will tell you this, I am more than blessed that if I were to show you pictures from when we understood the disease, when we learned about it, until the time that I received my liver transplant, you would even ask if I had liver disease. There might be a half dozen pictures out of the hundreds taken over those years where I look a little yellow. Man, I was lucky. I was blessed. I remember a specific situation near the end of my living with this diseased liver, where I was down at IU Med and I went in to talk to my doctor, and I said to him about a woman sitting next to me in the lobby, how sorry I felt for her. Oh my gosh, she was so yellow. I couldn't even describe the yellowness to you. It was like almost like a spicy mustard yellow, if that makes sense. It was very dark. And my heart hurt for this woman. And he looked me dead in the eye and he said, James, you're worse than she is. That blew my mind. And he said, you're just part of a very rare number of people who don't show symptoms That doesn't mean your symptoms don't exist. It means you don't show them. Because one of the symptoms of primary sclerosing cholangitis that people don't see is the internal pain. I love and I often like it, with a thumbs up or a heart if it's on Instagram, when people post about these unseen illnesses, because I totally understand it. I totally get it. You couldn't see the absolute pain, the ravaging pain that this disease would cause me. But I can tell you there were more than a few days, especially as it got closer to the end, where I was sleeping 18 hours a day. Since I did not teach in the summer, I was able to sleep some days 20 hours. And I wasn't exhausted from sleeping. I was exhausted from trying to manage this terrible disease. Now, my strand, if you will, I'll call it that, of primary sclerosing cholangitis is one that was misdiagnosed, believe it or not, way back in 1992. But in 1999, and we'll get to how that was misdiagnosed. In 1999, I spent more time in the hospital. Being in a hospital was very common for me. I mean, to spend 1 or 2 days. This particular episode was roughly a week or so, maybe not quite. But all that could be figured was that I had what was called pouchitis. Pouchitis, because I still had my J pouch inside. And remember, that J pouch was a turning of that small intestine where they cut it out and kind of make like this super cool bag inside your body. They hook it back up to your rectal muscles and you can go to the bathroom like, you know, anybody, which is great because you wouldn't know that in all technicality, that was an interior ostomy. So I still had that. But because I didn't have that large intestine there to absorb some of the minerals, some of the vitamins, some of the water that helps us stay sustained, that's a tongue twister, it was very easy for that pouch to get infected and inflamed. And that, again, just like taking iron when you are anemic, it burns. This pouchitis is terrible and it would rear its ugly head. You'd get it every 6 months or so, but for it to put you in the hospital means it was a pretty severe bout. In 99, it was. A couple of years later, in 2001, I got sick again with the exact same feeling. So I remember going into the hospital and saying to my doctor that this clearly pouchitis, let's just, you know, go after it and we'll understand that we'll probably need to throw antibiotics at it. Let's kill the infection. Boom, get me out of here. I stayed a month. That was early August of 2001 before I was able to come home. So it was early July through early August. I still had a couple of weeks at home to recover, but it was during that time that we started to put together some puzzle pieces. So I went into the hospital again with this intense intestinal pain, this guttural pain, and I could not tolerate the pain. So as is always a good suggestion, you better go to the ER if that's the case. When we got there, We immediately looked at that J pouch. Surprisingly, the J pouch was fine. There was no pouchitis. And that was confounding because it was the exact same pain and diagnosis that we had determined just a couple of years earlier. So we had to look elsewhere. But it seemed like each day or each couple of days that the doctor would come in and he would proffer some sort of answer that he believed was what was causing it, it was determined to be wrong. That's frustrating. And before you know it, we're 28 days in, and they took my gallbladder. And that gallbladder looked like some dried out chili pepper that you might see in the grocery store that you know, grind up and add to soup or something. It was just very, very tiny, shriveled. And amazingly, we couldn't find it. We couldn't find that that was the issue while I was in the hospital. Sad. Strange. But we wouldn't know for 7 years exactly how sad and strange that was. We just thought, okay, like anybody else, now I've lost my gallbladder. But now we'll forward to 2008 when we received the diagnosis of PSC. And there's, as I said, two strands, two ways you can look at primary sclerosing cholangitis. About 10% of people with ulcerative colitis get primary sclerosing cholangitis, PSC. But nearly everybody who has PSC also has ulcerative colitis. It's a happy little couple. I fell into that category. So my diagnosis in 1992, much like it was in 1985 when I was 14 and they thought it was a sugar, a milk sugar intolerance or lactose intolerance, to again, 1999 and then 2001, where I lost my gallbladder, we thought that these were all standalone events. They weren't. When we were able to finally screen for PSC and the discovery was made that this indeed was what it was, we were able to backtrack and realize exactly how PSC had destroyed not only my large intestine in 1992, but it also destroyed my gallbladder. Of all organs, it attacked the gallbladder in 1999 and again in 2001. How peculiar. But it wasn't done. The disease is nasty. Again, I cannot reiterate to you how many people who have this disease, some may be listening now, who are probably shaking their heads when I say, there are days you cannot get out of bed. Not that you don't want to. You simply cannot. Getting out of bed is too painful an experience. For me, because I didn't show symptoms, I felt an obligation to try. Because having one of those hidden diseases that people will have a tendency to actually question because they cannot see it really didn't seem like something I wanted to tend with. So there were days that my wife would help sit me up. There were days when my wife would help pull me out of bed. And almost like a momentum force, I was able to move after that, which is fantastic. And I'd go and I would put on my show in the classroom. I would perform for 6 hours a day and I'd come home and fall right to sleep. It was an 18-hour sleeping venture nearly every day for the last 4 months or so before I received my liver. Now, some of that time, again, thankfully, included the summer, so I was able to sleep a little bit more. So I was in Chicago when my phone call came. And there's a rule, at least with the doctors that I was with down in Indianapolis, that I could be 4 hours, exactly 4 hours away from the hospital at any given moment, and I didn't have to check in. If I went beyond that, and I chose to do that deliberately, I could be potentially sent back to the bottom of the transplant list because I broke protocol. So I knew exactly where I was in relationship to my hospital, 3 hours and 43 minutes away. And that was under 4 hours. So I knew exactly where I was on the off chance that I might get the phone call. So I had this planned out for some time, and then a phone call came, yes, from IU Med, but it was not the phone call that I was expecting some few months before my trip to Chicago. The phone call was to tell me that I was being removed from the transplant list, not because of any violation, but because the PSC had started to eat the lower left ventricle of my heart. That's right. A liver disease was eating my heart. That is how nasty this disease is. So they had to remove me, or suspend me, if you will, from the transplant list because they had to figure out how to help either stop that eating, if you will, or to somehow manage it until such time that I could get back on the liver transplant list. Now, for clarity, I'm not in Chicago at this point. I'm just here in Fort Wayne, Indiana, and the phone call came out of the blue. A lot of questions, a lot of whys that night, let me tell you, friends. A lot of whys. I'm not sure my whys were ever satisfied, and I can distinctly remember calling back, calling not the cardiologist, but my liver doctor, and asking him questions of why. Why am I being suspended? Shouldn't that mean you need to get in there quicker? You know, those are the types of questions you ask then, because now, on top of already feeling as though death could be creeping around your door, that level of mortality really takes a hit. And you know it's coming sooner than later. I wasn't quite ready. So I'm sure that's why a lot of my why questions went either unheard or simply didn't matter. The reality was that my heart, my lower left ventricle, was being attacked by the liver disease, and we needed to stop it. So I was off the transplant list for several months, nearly a year, while we attacked, if you will, this heart condition, working with a cardiologist from Indianapolis as well. Father's Day of 2015 came, and it's already a beautiful day because my boys always do such a great job of taking care of me on Father's Day. We have a particular pose we like to stick and take a picture of, and it goes back for, well, quite frankly, since I became the father of three boys, so for quite a while. But I got an amazing gift on Father's Day of 2015. I got a phone call from IU Med, and they said, "Happy Father's Day. You're back on the transplant list." And I said, "Really, why?" And they said, "Because my heart was not deteriorating any longer at that point, and they felt safe they could continue to put me on the transplant list." And she, my clinical coordinator at the time, told me it likely wouldn't be long. This is sad, but it's important to recognize that summertime is when most livers, especially, but several other organs, come in to hospitals because people are more reckless. People don't pay as much attention as they should, whether it's a boating accident or a motorcycle accident. We have a tendency, it seems, especially here in the Midwest, to almost feel immortal in the summertime. And so we don't do a very good job of taking care of our bodies, taking care of our needs. My phone call did come, and it came on July 24th, 2015. Now, that date may sound familiar because exactly 3 years to the day prior to this, I received my permanent ileostomy, July 24th, 2012. July 24th, 2015, I was in Chicago and I was finishing presenting at a conference for the NewTek Network as a teaching program where we do project-based learning environments inside of schools. And I was honored to be a presenter at this particular conference. But my presentations were over, so I had the ability to go back to my hotel room and sleep as much as I want And I did. So when the phone call came, it was rather late on that July 24th morning, 10 or 11 a.m. And on the other end was the donor network supervisor, the coordinator, and she had asked if I had eaten yet that day. Well, you can figure out pretty easily that that's code for, this is the call, where are you? And indeed, she asked, where are you? I told her I was in Chicago, exactly 3 hours and 43 minutes away. So she encouraged me to hustle. And on my way to Chicago, which I was blessed to have my co-teacher join me and help drive me so I didn't, you know, go crazy, we hit a traffic jam. We hit a huge traffic jam near West Lafayette. Massive. And in this traffic jam, we were begging, praying that somehow or another we could find an officer who might direct us through the traffic jam. And that officer appeared. Now, he didn't lead us through the traffic jam, but he did call ahead to find out how much more time we would be stuck in the traffic jam. And he let us know that we had been through the worst part of it. And thankfully, we were allowed to, once we got to the end of the traffic jam, we could speed, do whatever we needed to safely do to get to Indianapolis. If we got pulled over again, he gave us our business card and told us to continue on. So we felt covered that day. I felt particularly like everything is going very smoothly. We get to the hospital and the brakes come on. Now, a lot of times in the transplant world, you have like a false run where you may get called down to the hospital you're receiving the transplant at. And it's a no-go because they have to first check you before they make a decision if they're going to procure that organ for you. So once you get there, if for whatever reason you're spiking a fever or you have a cold or something worse, you are not healthy enough to receive that liver. However, if you pass those rudimentary type tests, they can go on site to procure the organ for you, but that organ may have been damaged more than they realize. It may not be viable by the time they get there. So there are many, many factors that can go into place. Well, in this case, it was my big mouth. It was my big mouth that almost put the brakes on this operation, no pun intended. Because I said that, boy, my heart can't seem to calm down. Well, of course, I was just talking about my anxiousness of the whole episode. My gosh, we had just driven 4 hours from Chicagoland. We landed. My wife met me there. My kids were there. My parents were there. And there was almost this palpable excitement in the room. But I said my heart couldn't calm down. So they brought in the cardiologist, who ran a battery of tests on me. And once again, since this was the cardiologist on call and not my cardiologist, questioned why there seemed to be a thickening of the walls and the lower left ventricle, and would I actually be able to receive this liver? James, keep your mouth shut next time. It took more than a little bit of time for them to acknowledge I was able to safely receive that organ. And it wasn't until that moment, which was several hours after I actually got to IU. So I met the deadline of getting there within that 4 hours, but it was 2-3, maybe close to 4 hours before they were able to go and procure the organ from my organ donor. The wait seemed endless. By this point, we had sent my co-teacher, her name was Lynn, we had sent her back to Fort Wayne. We had made tons of calls. There was this palpable tension in the room at this point because we're all just sitting around waiting. We still don't know if the transplant's going to happen. We've been through every other checkpoint, if you will. And then my mouth got in the way and kept us from moving faster. Did I somehow screw this up and they'll get on site and realize, had they been able to receive that organ earlier, it would have been viable? We just heard nothing. And then finally, about 6 or 7 hours after first receiving that phone call, maybe 8 hours, in walked the charge nurse, and she said, "It's good. You're ready to go." Well, it's a little bit like slapstick comedy at that point, because you're going from 0 to 100. Your emotions are all over the wall. You don't know if you're laughing or crying or what the expectation is. You just know that all of a sudden you've got these whoop, 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 whoop kind of noises going on because everybody's moving around. Pieces are in play, but you have one thing you need to do: get in the wheelchair and get to the operating room. That's your only job. So when you say, "Okay, well, let me say goodbye to my boys," it was kind of, the nurse kind of leaned in and said, "Okay, but we got to go." And then I wanted to give my wife a kiss and talk with her a little bit about last moment expectations, and my parents. And if you know my mom especially, she's a hugger, but she doesn't let go. So, you know, here we're having to say to my mom, "I gotta go," you know, and the emotional effect that comes with it. Now, I'm partly joking about my mom. She's been through enough medical to understand herself the importance of when it's time to go, you have to go. And so go I did. And I went down to the ER. And I remember my mind was blank. My mind was blank. I was quite literally thinking of nothing. I was just absorbing the whoosh sound that came with being pushed down the hall. I was absorbing the cool air that was hitting my face after an intense day of, you know, frankly, raised blood pressure from the anxiety, the heat of being underneath the hospital bed lights for so many hours and what seemed to be no movement whatsoever. So I was enjoying that last moment. And I suppose subliminally, I was enjoying the fact that I'm at complete peace, regardless of what comes next. I'm at complete peace. And then suddenly, the wheelchair stopped. They didn't enter the surgical room. They stopped short of the door and made me get up and walk. And I thought, well, that's just cruel. But I've come to learn that that's policy. That's kind of what they do. Maybe it's to simply just get your mind off of it. If they're carting you around and doing everything for you, you're not going to get comfortable with the idea of doing things for yourself. That's what I'm going to tell myself, at least. I like that idea. Maybe it was just something as mundane as keeping as many germs out of the OR as possible. But I remember once I got in there, introducing myself, praying for my surgeons. And I said, "I hope that that's not awkward." And they informed me that it was more common than I might imagine. And that again gave me peace. So I didn't pray that I would make it through the surgery. I prayed that they would do everything that they could to save my life in the face that somebody else had to die today. And as we get to the next episode, I will share with you not only her story, my donor's story, but the unreal coincidences that bind us together. Even to this day, the discoveries that I made about my donor that in some way made the guilt worse. The survivor's guilt that comes with the knowledge that someone else died so that you can live. But this much I can tell you. Regardless of whether I had a connection with my donor or not, the fact that she took the time to register the fact that she took the time to think of others and that she knew that in the event of her own death, that she could still help save the lives of more than one person is a gift I wish more people would do. It's a simple thing to do. Now, religious beliefs may be different in all of us. And there may be some of us, I've met more than one person who says, well, you can do what you want with X organ or Y organ, but don't touch my heart. I love the sentimentality of that. But the fact that you would even take the time to think of somebody else, that the world is bigger than one person, that to me is the ultimate example of living life right. To me, that is the purest form of love. And I would encourage everyone to consider recycling their organs when they no longer need them. You'd be surprised how many people's lives can be changed with a simple gift such as that. I'll give you some tips here in the outro, in the closing, on how to do that. But know this. My life was exponentially changed, not once, not twice, but three times because of gifted surgeons, three times because somebody else used their skills to save my life. But ultimately, it was the gift of one person and then the gift of life from my God that allows me to talk to you today. Let's discuss that guilt. Let's discuss my friend that donated her organ in the next few minutes on the other side of The Art of Letting Go. Hey gang, it's James Steensma. I want to share with you another statistic, maybe two. Did you know that 95% of Americans agree with the idea of organ donation? Yet only 54% of us are actually signed up to donate. That's wild, isn't it? So if you have thought about being an organ donor, but you haven't yet done it, please go to organdonor.gov. Organdonor.gov. Or if you know your state's website for organ donation, go there too. It only takes between 30 and 60 seconds, but you are creating a second or third or fourth chance for somebody to live and live well. Please do that for me. Also, remember, if you are in a moment of crisis, or you are depressed or anxious, text 741-741. It's the crisis text line. They will pair you with somebody who has your best interest at heart and will not let you walk through that grief alone. 741-741, the crisis text line. Until next time, I'm James Steensma for The Art of Letting Go.